the Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Welcome to the latest edition of the Peter B. Collins Show, originating in San Francisco. Our program is supported by listeners, great Americans like Mark Brodsky of suburban Chicago and Don Sisney of Olalla, Washington. You can sign up for a voluntary subscription for as little as $5 a month. And I appreciate your support. It helps keeps the light turned on here, the phones working, and all that kind of stuff. Leading off today's program, Robert Perry, journalist and analyst. He publishes at consortiumnews.com. I always overpronounce that to make it easier for you to spell it. He probably says consortium. And he worked for AP and Newsweek and Frontline and went independent over 10 years ago. And his nonprofit journalism site is a treasure, and I hope you will support it if you're in a position to do so. Robert Perry, welcome back to our program.
Thanks, Peter.
Always good to talk with you, Bob. And there is some relief for me that after months of my griping and sniping and complaining, that there is a fairly robust debate underway about our policy and the future of American troops and presence in Afghanistan. And now I'm not terribly optimistic about how it's going to turn out. I think that Obama probably will decide to put more troops in there. But you wrote a piece of analysis recently that's up at consortiumnews.com, headlined, Al-Qaeda Outwitted Bush and the Neocons. And this echoes something that I've been saying for a long time, that Bush fulfilled the wildest dreams of Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri, or Zawahiri, however they pronounce the Egyptian medical doctor's name. And by committing U.S. troops long-term to Islamic soil, by parking 160,000 at the peak American troops in Iraq, and by slogging through this ongoing effort to pacify Afghanistan, we really have fallen into the trap that they laid for us.
Well, I think it's almost more that Bush created the trap that he then fell into, he and his neocon advisors. I mean, this was a sort of more of an unforced error than any genius work by al-Qaeda, really. But basically, we know, based on some intercepted documents, that, for instance, there was a memo or letter written by one of bin Laden's deputies named Atiya. And he wrote it to Zarqawi when Zarqawi was running the al-Qaeda affiliate in Iraq. This is in 2005.
And let's call it a franchise, because it wasn't a company-owned store.
No, it was more of a franchise, exactly. It was something that just kind of got that Zawahiri got set up using the al-Qaeda brand, basically, and used that to raise money for his brutal and rather reckless activities. And this letter is interesting, the one from Atiya, in part because he upbraids Zarqawi for being so rash and reckless and urges him to move at a more reasonable pace. And then Atiya says in this letter, he says, prolonging the war in Iraq is in our interest. In other words, he spells out what was obvious to many analysts, that Bush's policies were a dream come true for al-Qaeda. What it allowed the al-Qaeda to do was a gift to them, because by having that quick pivot out of Afghanistan after the invasion of Afghanistan and then refocusing on Iraq, that really bought precious time for al-Qaeda's leadership to reestablish themselves in the border area between Afghanistan and Pakistan. It allowed them to rebuild their forces and their money. They had to reestablish some of their financial networks. So all that could be done, as well as the fact that by sending the U.S. troops into Iraq, they eliminated, Bush and the neocons eliminated Saddam Hussein, who was one of the rivals mm-hmm. to Osama bin Laden, because Hussein was a secularist and al-Qaeda represented the fundamentalist approach to Islam. So you had that, and then of course you had just this amazing advertisement for suicide bombers. Here's the United States going into a Muslim country in the center of the Middle East and slaughtering lots of Muslims. So it became a wonderful recruiting ground and training ground, in effect, for insurgents and for suicide bombers. So you had this extraordinary gift that was handed to al-Qaeda. But the reason it's really important now is that it's becoming increasingly clear that the window for the United States and NATO to have done something constructive in Afghanistan after the invasion has pretty well closed. That if they were going to do it, they had to do it fairly quickly before the Afghans came to see them as occupiers. Maybe initially some Afghans who were fed up with the Taliban and their extremism might have somewhat welcomed a new approach and some aid from the outside world. But 8 years on, the view of the NATO and U.S. forces has changed. And it's much more a resentment. The American forces, especially through some of the bombing has killed countless Afghan civilians, many because of accidental attacks or indiscriminate attacks aimed at militant targets, but when they went awry. Mm-hmm. So you've had all these reasons now for the bitterness of the Afghans to be redirected toward these Western forces occupying their country, and many have now come to see the Taliban and to maybe a lesser degree al-Qaeda as allies in this fight.
Well, and there are a couple of things here that have shifted, and we're not really acknowledging them. You know, serially, Obama is on record acknowledging many of the critical negatives about our situation in Afghanistan and the prospect of expanding the U.S. troop presence there. But when you put it all together into any kind of a comprehensive package, we have a very serious case of mission creep here, where, you know, originally we said we were going in to take the head off al-Qaeda, and we now know, based on our own U.S. generals' acknowledgments, that there are 100 or fewer al-Qaeda members in Afghanistan. And they say, well, yeah, but if we pull out, they'll open up those camps again, and they'll, you know, use Afghanistan as a staging area. Well, the truth is they don't need Afghanistan as a staging area, and they can stage almost anywhere they happen to want to conspire for their next bloody event. And so, you know, we have a lot of dated rationales that are no longer operative in terms of, you know, why the U.S. would be or should be in Afghanistan. And I think Obama has an opportunity to pivot here and say, well, you know, I've spent the last 9 months studying this very carefully. We've had umpteen War Council meetings. And frankly, you know, I now know as much as I can about this, and I cannot rationalize putting more troops in there because it won't have the desired effect. We can't put 600,000 in there to really conduct a thorough counterinsurgency effort. And so, you know, my fear is that he's going to go for some sort of a compromise package that leaves American troops vulnerable, that leaves our presence there as a major irritant and a promoter of Taliban interests, and that still leaves the signal very clear to Afghanis that we'll not be there for 50 years. The Taliban will. And whenever we pull out, those scores will be settled. And that's what prevents people from allowing us to win their proverbial hearts and minds, Bob.
Well, Well, I think all that's correct. I think the and I think there was a very interesting letter, which I included a good deal of in this article you referenced at consortiumnews.com, but by a former Marine captain named Matthew Ho.
Yeah, I saw him on the PBS NewsHour this week, and he's a very credible guy with very substantive issues he's raising.
Right. The letter is really worth everyone reading. I have a link to it in the article. And it is he was a guy who not only did he serve in Iraq as a Marine officer, but he was then hired to be a development person for the State Department in Afghanistan. And after a period of time working at this and being highly regarded and as one of the stars in that region, he resigned. He said, "It is too late." In essence, that we are, the United States increasingly is seen as the occupying force, that the possibility of success is so low, and the bar for success is also so low, that it's not worth the treasure and the blood of the United States and the servicemen and women over there. So he basically took a position that it's almost criminal to continue this flawed effort, this bungled effort. If things had been done differently at the beginning, if there hadn't been this obsession with turning on Iraq in 2001 and 2002, rather than trying to do what might make sense for Afghanistan, which is an amazingly difficult undertaking in itself, if there hadn't been this neocon hubris of the Bush administration, maybe there might have been some chance of getting some good out of this bad, but his point at this stage is that there really isn't that hope. I think what Obama's facing, though, is more of a political dynamic than a military or even a geopolitical dynamic. He's dealing with pressures in Washington to not show weakness, to be tough, to not accept defeat. He's being baited by the same neocons who made the misjudgment in 2002 to transfer American resources toward Iraq. But he still has to face that. And the neocons, even though they were in a sense defeated when the Bush administration was more or less driven out of office, they remain extremely influential. People around the country, I'm not sure, understand how in Washington the think tanks are dominated by neocons. The Washington Post, the major paper in Washington, is dominated by neocons.
Mm-hmm.
To a greater extent, now the New York Times seems almost increasingly, day by day, more influenced by neocons. So instead of a waning force, which you might expect given the catastrophes that they took our country through, the neocons are actually on their way back. They're very well established, very well funded. They get published by the biggest houses, the biggest publishing houses in the United States, and they get to promote their books and their arguments on all the radio talk shows that they have at their beck and call. They can show up on all the important TV shows, and so this is a problem that Obama has to confront, and there really isn't an awful lot countering this continuing neocon influence in the nation's capital.
And I agree with you about that, and there are two threads here that I'd like you to react to in that vein. One is that holding over Robert Gates as defense secretary has left a whole second layer of Rumsfeld and Bush-oriented people who are still there in the Pentagon bureaucracy and, in my view, still populating much of our foreign policy apparatus. The second thread that ties in with Gates is that politically, I think Obama made a mistake when during the campaign last year, he decided not to challenge the popular notion that the surge in Iraq worked. And when McCain brought it up in a debate, I felt that Obama just kind of let it slide instead of confronting that issue. And the combination of Gates staying on with the neocon underlings and this concept that the surge worked in Iraq, and we're seeing today that, car bombings and violent episodes continue in Iraq, that nation is not pacified. It's certainly better than it was at the bottom in 2005, 2006. But we can't declare that we have succeeded in Iraq, and you know that these are models that we can transfer to Afghanistan.
Well, also, Peter, though, the surge was only a minor factor in any improvement.
Oh, I agree.
This was, you know, but I think the point you're making is a good one. It wasn't just Obama's fault. Actually, Obama did challenge the idea that the surge was a success, and he was pummeled by people like George Stephanopoulos on ABC's This Week, and all the pundits. Every time they had a chance to talk to him, all the anchors, and they would pummel him. Why can't you admit that the surge was a great success? Because that had become conventional wisdom. It wasn't true. And even someone like Bob Woodward, in his book on this period, acknowledges that based on his interviews with senior military people, that the surge was a minor factor. Much more important was the essentially paying off of the Sunni tribes in Anbar and the surprising standing down by the Sadr forces.
Yeah.
In the Shiite community,
and I don't,
much of
and
which,
I don't,
by the way, was organized through the Iranians,
right? And I don't think Sadr's quiet period is going to last.
Well, we may or may not. It's certainly there's a lot of tension that remains there. But I mean, the point is that the surge, the adding up of another 20-some thousand or so American troops, was not a big factor, but it was something the neocons pushed because they were trying to find a way to rehabilitate themselves for the mess they'd gotten the country into. So their extraordinary influence over the Washington power centers and opinion centers showed itself in their ability to transform the fact that there were these troops added and there was a decline in violence. They were able to put to brand that as they wished, which was a successful surge,
mm-hmm.
when the reality was far different. And it wasn't also beyond the what happened with the Sunnis in Anbar, which preceded the surge. There was also the killing of Zarqawi, which was in June of 2006. That was a factor. And there were classified programs, essentially hit squad programs, that had been going on for some time that had become increasingly effective. The United States was in effect running death squads in Iraq. That's something that Woodward sort of references, but only obliquely. He says he can't talk about it because it was classified. But there were all these methods that were being used so the surge became a phony explanation, a myth, if you will. But then during the 2008 campaign, the press, which had absorbed this myth, just pounded Obama whenever he tried to actually say, well, it wasn't that simple, which he did try to say a few times and was essentially shouted down. So he basically said, well, you know, discretion being the better part of valor, I'll just sort of say, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, you're right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's how our history is developed. But there are problems with that, because now the neocons have reestablished themselves saying, see, we're right about the surge. The surge solved the Iraq problem. And now we need another surge in Afghanistan. So sometimes when you accept a false premise or a false version of history, because it's easier, it avoids a big argument, that in a place like Washington can then become the floor of a whole new set of misguided policies.
Yeah. Now, returning to Matthew Ho, H-O-H, I think this is a very important statement, both the letter that he wrote and the statement he made by resigning his position. And I recently saw a powerful documentary that I recommend to people. It's showing up around the country in different art theaters. It's called The Most Dangerous Man in America. It's about Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers. And Ellsberg has been trying to link his action 30 years ago, maybe it's 40 now, with the need for a new Daniel Ellsberg in the current environment. And while Ho hasn't published classified documents or anything of that sort, his public statements and courageous stand here, I think, do offer us an example. And I'd love to see more people come forward who would tell the truth about the intractability of the situation in Afghanistan and just call it what it is, a 35-year-old civil war. You know, that's not news. But it's a fresh description that our media hasn't recently used to describe our invasion and occupation there in Afghanistan.
You're right. I happened to see the movie last night, the documentary.
Oh, good.
Ellsberg was there. It was presented at the visitor center at the Capitol building. And it was a very impressive documentary. And I think many of the lessons are relevant today, but some aren't. There's a good question in my mind whether, having worked in the mainstream media for all those years, that the mainstream media is not what it was then.
Yeah.
And I think it would be very difficult. There'd be a real unwillingness on the part of much of the Washington press corps take on those kinds of stories. Obviously, if you have something like the Pentagon Papers dropped in your lap, which is pretty much what happened to the New York Times, you have to make a calculation. And it was actually in the documentary, it was Hedrick Smith who was saying that he said, "Well, the problem, the situation the Times faced was, what if we didn't run them? What if if people knew we'd had these important documents and we had chickened out? That would be more of a harm to the New York Times." Than going through the fight of running them. So it wasn't exactly waving the First Amendment around. It was sort of a calculation. But these days, we had another case with the New York Times. This was back in 2004, when James Risen, one of its reporters, came upon the story. A leaker came in and told them about the illegal wiretapping that was going on by the Bush administration through the NSA, and the New York Times confirmed the story prior to the election in 2004.
Yeah.
And they were told by the White House to hold it, and they complied. The publisher that time said, "Oh, okay, we'll hold the story." So they spiked Risen's story, and the only reason they finally published it in December of 2005, more than a year later, was that Risen had gotten a book contract and was going to include the story in his book,
yeah,
which was coming out in January.
Mm-hmm.
So the Times said, "Oh my goodness, it looked like the same kind of situation occurred." But finally, only in that moment, rather than anticipating the problem, they actually were faced with it, and they decided we better rush the story out because we'll look worse if we don't.
And here's another example from that same set of issues, Bob. Mark Klein is the retired AT&T technician from here in San Francisco, who exposed the illegal, not unwarrantless or whatever we call that, it was illegal wiretapping, a massive diversion of a communication switch in San Francisco and in at least 20 other telephone offices around the country. And Klein took his information to Risen and Lichtblau, who sat on it. He also took it to the Los Angeles Times. They didn't sit on it. They gave it to John Negroponte, who was then the so-called intelligence czar running the national intelligence apparatus. And the L.A. Times never published Mark Klein's information. Instead, they basically turned on him, a confidential source, gave his materials to the government, and then complied, presumably, with an instruction not to publish.
Well, I think that's what's been happening. There was an interesting line in the documentary on Ellsberg, where one of the, I think it was Hedrick Smith, said, the New York Times said, you know, that what happened with the Ellsberg case changed the relationship between the American press and the U.S. government to this day. And I remember I heard that, and I sort of, having been through much of this over the past 30 years, I kind of groaned quietly. Ray McGovern was sitting next to me, and I kind of groaned over to Ray. And later, David Swanson, mm-hmm, a bright young activist who does some writing for us, David asked a question, said that didn't really sit well with him because he doesn't think that is the case anymore. And I think the truth is that over those 30 years, and in fact, partly because of the Pentagon Paper case, the government, especially the Republicans and the conservatives, began to figure out how to counter that, and they built up institutions. There were attack groups to go after reporters. There were think tanks who would put out whatever they wanted to have supported. They built their own media infrastructure, newspapers, magazines, ultimately TV and radio and so forth. And they built all that, and intimidated to a great extent the major news organizations into a more cowardly position. And one often where you had people inside the big news organizations that sympathized with whether it be Ronald Reagan or George H.W. Bush or later George W. Bush. So you had basically the press becoming a different animal. The press was tamed. It went from being a moderate attack dog, let's say, at least a dog that might defend your house, and turned into a lapdog. And the success with that is what has really altered this dynamic. And so I think what Swanson was asking was, his point he was making was quite well taken. And I think it's absurd to think that this relationship with that people still think of the Watergate period and the Pentagon Papers period as the model of how the American press operates. It isn't. That's way, way in the past. And what we're seeing now is more like what you're talking about. And there are plenty of other examples. You know, mm-hmm. the Gary Webb case where Webb brought up the Contra drug issue back in the 90s and was attacked not by the government as much as by his fellow journalists at the New York Times and the Washington Post and the LA Times. And those papers essentially ignored the larger story, which was that the CIA had protected and knew about and protected drug traffickers who were operating under the umbrella of the Nicaraguan Contra movement that Ronald Reagan had been supporting. Mm-hmm. So that was the real story, but the way it was flipped was to attack Gary Webb for having done the story, not dealing with the underlying and far more significant crime. That's just how it is now, and I think Americans have to recognize that, and we have to figure out ways to build honest institutions that will go back to tell the truth.
Also, the film I was pleased to see profiles two people who remain on the scene, Pete McCloskey, who was a Republican congressman from California, who helped get the Pentagon Papers out there, and who also courageously challenged Richard Nixon in his party's primary in 1968, and then, or was it, no, 72. 72 it was when he challenged. And also Mike Gravel, who came off as a bit of a loon in the 2008 presidential campaign. He was a freshman senator from Alaska who in some ways didn't know quite what he was doing, but he did know that he was performing an important service. And so I was pleased that those two people were shown in the film as well.
Right.
So, Bob, I want to shift now to another piece that you have at consortiumnews.com from a few days ago. And this regards the media once again. And you're saying that while this whole concept of the public option is, I call it a UFO, we don't know exactly what it will be in its final form, but the wrangling over it was something that the media has been confidently predicting would lead to, you know, basically no public option included on the Senate side and a futile effort on the part of the House to include a public option. And it is interesting to see how they embraced conventional wisdom and made that out to be an expectation that everyone should have bought into.
Right. Basically, the mainstream media in Washington treated the idea of a public option as some kind of left-wing, loony idea that made no sense and was just, that didn't need to be there, was kind of nutty. And so it was dismissive. And the fact that often the polls would show that despite that treatment it was getting inside the media, that by 2-1 Americans tended to support it, certainly majorities tended to support it, that just kind of wasn't acceptable to the mainstream media. There were these know-it-alls, and I focused on in the piece on one at CNN's Dana Bash, who had been talking about how the only worthwhile piece of legislation was the one coming out of the Senate Finance Committee, and that's why all the important journalists were focusing on that alone. And it turned out, of course, that the Senate Finance Committee bill was not that important. That it was kind of an amalgam of rather weird ideas and didn't quite altogether add up. It did not have a public option. It had one with a co-op idea, which is generally referred is just thought of by I think by any people who actually follow this issue as rather a non-starter, one that wouldn't really save any money or do much good. But that was one embraced by the mainstream press. And then when Harry Reid came out last week and said he was going to actually it was even this week, but he came out and said I'm going to include a public option, albeit a rather weak one, in the Senate bill. There was this almost anger on the part of the journalists who sort of were baited him during the this press conference, including Dana Bash, who at the end was shouting at him about how, you know, aren't you just doing this to appease the liberals? What you saw was the Washington Press Corps, which had been entirely wrong, had done lousy reporting, and through all this period, by the way, there are many leading members of many leading Democrats on Capitol Hill who were assuring the press that a public option would be included in some form. And all that was being ignored and swept aside because the conventional wisdom was that, no, there'd be no public option. And once they once the know-it-all press reached that conclusion, there wasn't any reason to, even for people involved, the newsmakers, to actually have a say in this. It turned out, however, that they did have a say in this, and the reporters were kind of miffed not at themselves for being incompetent and
right,
but at the politicians for not doing what the pundits were certain they would do.
Yeah, well, and I think it shows that the Beltway mindset is heavily influenced by lobbyists. And that, with all the money being spent, with all the jobs that have been created for lobbyists just in the past year, just on the health reform issues, there is, on the cocktail circuit, and when you go out to dinner at a nice restaurant in Washington, the people you hear and see and talk to are all part of the insider game. And they're, confident that all of their efforts to make sure that the health insurance industry benefits and doesn't really cough up too much more than pre-existing conditions in this process, they all, operate with a kind of certainty that they're going to get their way because, hey, they've got the big money and the establishment behind them.
Well, I guess that's somewhat correct. I think there's a real problem, and this is part of my criticism of the progressive community, in that especially, another thing happened sort of in the 70s was that the progressive community, which had a very strong voice in Washington at that time, it had some important think tanks, the Institute for Policy Study was quite big at the time, there were media outlets, there was a lot of that, a support network, really, when Dan Ellsberg was doing his courageous whistleblowing, there was actually a support network to get his story out, and that influenced what the big papers did, because they were sort of under some pressure from the left, which had this its own megaphone, that they didn't want to be seen as completely ignoring some of these important stories. Now, what happened in the late 70s or so is that the progressive sort of abandoned Washington. They felt they'd go back to the countryside. Many of them moved to the Bay Area and San Francisco, and to this day, many of the progressive media institutions, to the degree they exist, are based in places like Los Angeles and San Francisco, mm-hmm. maybe some places like Madison, Wisconsin, but there's very little presence in Washington. Sometimes, like the Huffington Post, might have a couple people assigned to their Washington office, but their main operations are in Los Angeles.
Right.
So you end up with this. So instead of having this possibility of a cumulative effect, that is, that if there were a lot more people who had a progressive view, who are at these meetings, at these events, talking to people, that could actually matter. If someone's spouse was married, or if someone's spouse was working for one of these organizations, that sort of thing matters in the real world of Washington. The fact that the progressives have chosen not to do that has been extremely harmful. It's allowed the right, it did the opposite. The right moved their institutions to Washington. Even something like the American Spectator, which was an influential magazine, especially in the 90s, they were based in Indiana. They were told by the rich right-wing foundations that they had to move to Washington. That's where the action was. So as the left left Washington, the right moved into Washington, and that has had an enormous impact in a variety of ways. And as you described, just the conventional wisdom, the thinking, it becomes something that pervades everything, because you're not getting very many people from a progressive standpoint in this world saying, hold it, that's not right.
Yeah.
And so you almost need that kind of institutional anchor to counter the noise that they're getting from the lobbyists and that they're getting from the right-wing media and they're getting from the right-wing think tanks. It's hard for people to go against all that.
I also think that there is a lack of coherence on the part of the Democrats who are attempting to lead this charge, whether we talk about those at the White House who even to this date have failed to define what is a make-or-break set of issues for a bill that Obama would sign, or what would cause him to veto a bill. And we also have this fast-and-loose game that has been played where the public option is a pacifier aimed at those of us who believe in single-payer and those of us who believe that the real problem that needs to be fixed is the profit motive and the profit margins that the insurance companies enjoy in delivering their service. And so the idea that a public option with opt-in or opt-out or triggers, a public option that might apply to only 10% of people who currently don't have health insurance in this country, you know, these are all things that are symbolic in most respects, aimed at trying to keep the active left that was focused on single payer from deserting the compromises that will inevitably form whatever package Obama signs and declares victory with.
Well, I think that's correct to a great extent. I think the left, though, still has to take some of the responsibility that if there were a stronger progressive media infrastructure, megaphone, however you want to call it, then there'd be a lot more support for these things. It's hard to expect politicians to take a position that it does not have that kind of broad support within the policy circles. And so there's no question. I think anyone who looks at this seriously would say that single payer is the most rational of the approaches. So it would save the most money and provide the best bang for the buck in terms of health care.
Mm-hmm.
But there has been there are powerful forces against it. The left has not marshaled itself since the 70s in an effective way in that regard. So you have politicians trying to make deals. What we've seen, though, with the public option, you're right about this, is, you know, I would consider it the incredible shrinking public option. When we started this, even the public option, if you remember the arguments that were made at the very beginning by people like Grassley, based on the Lewin Group, this sort of industry-based think tank, was that 119 million Americans were ready to defect to the public option. So what we started seeing were limitations. First, and the most important one was that, well, we're not going to allow big companies that currently have insurance programs to go to the public option. They're stuck with private insurers. Then there was also, well, we're not going to let this thing even start till 2013.
Right.
So that gives the insurance companies another 3+ years to do whatever they want to us, more or less. And now, by going from the so-called robust plan to this negotiated rate plan, the robust plan would tie it to Medicare standards, which would be a cheaper, more effective way of setting these price levels for services. By now having to require this public option to negotiate, the CBO now estimates that instead of it was going to be 10 or 12 million Americans under the public option, it's now down to 6 million, according to the House plan. So what we're talking about Obama's sort of unintentionally correct when he talks about it being a sliver of the plan. It has become a sliver of the plan. And it's now believed by CBO that the rates, if you sign up for the public option in 2013, you will be paying more than if you stay with one of the private plans.
Because
they think that the private plans will still find ways to sort of shift the sick people away from them.
Right.
Even if they're not allowed to legally, they will find ways to do it. So that means the public option will have to charge more to the people who are getting that program because it will have a disproportionate number of sick people under it.
Well, and I have heard, and I can't, you know, this is stuff I've read on the internets, but that there is this thread that suggests that the public option will in fact be managed under contract by a for-profit insurance company.
Well, that could be the end result, although I think the plan, I think, still is to have it under done through some government office. But the obvious way to do that and make it work would be to say, okay, it'll be 5% above Medicare rates, say, to give the doctors more of an incentive. But that would, and that would have an effect of really pulling down costs. It would force doctors to be a little more careful what they order up. It also would put pressure on the insurance industry. But if the public option ends up being more expensive than what the private insurers can do, it doesn't have much benefit for anything. I mean, it has been made into something that maybe people will sign up for because they're really sick and they trust the government not to try to nickel and dime them out of care they need. But that in turn will force higher rates, which is what CBO predicts.
Yeah. Robert Perry, always great to talk with you. Thank you for joining me today here on the Peter B. Collins Show.
Thank you, Peter.
And read his work at consortiumnews.com. We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show, and our final segment today will be a tribute to my friend, the great harmonica player, Norton Buffalo. Our program is sponsored by the Organic Wine Company. Now that you're eating organic, it's time to wash it down with earth-friendly wines imported by the Organic Wine Company since 1980. Just click on the link on my homepage at peterbcollins.com for a special introductory offer. Our music of the moment from David Bowie. It's a criminal world, he sings. But wait a minute. What about my constitutional rights? What about the presumption of innocence until proven guilty? Well, the right-wing dreaded American Civil Liberties Union is at it again, fighting for our constitutional rights. And San Francisco ACLU attorney Michael Risher joins me now. Welcome, Michael.
Good to be here. Thanks.
Well, and thank you for the work that you do and some of the abuse that you take from various interests who take exception from time to time to the positions that you stake out. But I'm solidly behind you on this one. Proposition 69 in California was passed in 2004. It took effect this past January. And it requires police departments to take a DNA sample of someone who is simply arrested for a potential felony. And then if the charges are dropped, if the person is found innocent, if they're unable to prove the case, well, that DNA sample remains in the state database. And I have grave concerns about this. Tell us about the legal matter here. What are our constitutional rights? And to what extent do you think Prop 69 violates those rights?
Prop 69 does violate our constitutional rights. Part of the initiative went into effect immediately when the proposition passed, but as you said, this new arrestee testing provision, which allows a single police officer who suspects you of a crime, and a felony in California can be anything from second-time shoplifting or first-time shoplifting, even to simple possession of drugs to writing a bad check.
And can you pause for a moment and just give us the textbook definition? A felony is simply any crime that requires state prison time, and that at the current level is about a year of prison time, right?
Right. A felony is any crime where you could be sent to state prison. Doesn't a lot of people who are arrested or even convicted of felonies don't go to state prison. They get probation.
Mm-hmm.
More importantly, a lot of people who are arrested for felonies are, in fact, innocent. For example, if a car full of people gets stopped and a police officer finds some drugs in the car, he can legally arrest all four people to conduct further investigation. Under today's law, all four of those people would have to give a DNA sample, be put in a felony database, and for people who aren't charged, for example, say they then interviewed the people in the car and found that the drugs belonged to the owner of the car, the passengers would never be charged, probably, and they would find that their DNA is in this statewide, national, really, criminal database, and for at least 3 years, they would not be able even to ask to have that sample removed. And we think this is a violation of Californians' privacy rights, their constitutional rights to be free from unreasonable search and seizure, and their constitutional rights to control their personal information, here their genetic privacy.
Well, and I have become a real hardliner about the Fourth Amendment, Michael, because I feel that what happened during the Bush-Cheney administration, the illegal wiretapping and diversion of our email traffic, was a serious incursion. The Obama administration has not only declined to fix that, they're extending some of the bad law at the federal level. And here at the state level, we see a creeping police state in the form of this DNA collection program. And, you know, I had problems with it when it started out confined to the prison population in California, because there is this, again, presumption of guilt that in taking this information and putting it in a database that is widely accessible to law enforcement, you're creating a new class of people who are suspects of crime, whether they've had any inclination, whether there's any evidence to support it or not.
And that's absolutely right. There are a number of things you just said which could, in themselves, show why this shouldn't be done. But let me just focus on the last thing you said, of we're generating a criminal database full of people, many of whom are innocent, of the roughly 300,000 people arrested on suspicion of a felony in California every year. About 100,000 of them are never convicted of anything. Those people, unless they somehow manage to get their DNA out of this database, which is really, for most people, virtually an impossible thing to try to do, they will be suspects, automatically be suspects in any future case where DNA evidence is involved, which, as DNA evidence becomes more and more important to our criminal justice system, becomes more and more crimes that they'll be automatic suspects for.
Mm-hmm.
Even more disturbing for some folks, we're moving beyond using DNA and DNA data banks in the way that people thought about them when they voted to enact Prop 69. It used to be DNA data banks, you think, okay, you've got them full of people who've been convicted of very serious crimes, murder, sexual assaults, things like that. They've been convicted, so you're pretty sure that they actually did them, and they're serious crimes, so you want to make sure that if they're involved in them, that we catch those folks. And, of course, folks who are involved in that type of criminal activity are more likely to be involved in the same type of criminal activity. So that made a lot of sense to have DNA data banks with just DNA from people convicted of serious felonies. We expand that to arrestees, many of whom will be innocent, expand it to minor crimes, writing a bad check, simple drug possession, and the database becomes much less useful. In addition, now we're not just looking at people who show up as a perfect match, where you've got a crime scene sample, you run against the database, bam, you've got a perfect match. You know that the person associated with that DNA of the database may have been involved in the crime because his DNA was left there.
Mm-hmm.
California has moved beyond that to what they call familial searching, where you run your crime scene against the database, you don't get a perfect match. Instead, you get some matches that are kind of close. You know these people are not the ones you're looking for because the DNA doesn't match. Nonetheless, on the theory that maybe because these folks' DNA is similar to what you found at the crime scene, a relative of theirs could have left the DNA, you go after these folks, start investigating them, maybe questioning them, investigating their families, based just because the DNA was similar. So you're really seeing an expansion not only of the types of people who have their DNA profiles included in the database, but in the ways these databases are being used, in ways that are quite invasive of familial privacy here.
And, Michael, there's also, I think, a presumption by many people that law enforcement activities are untainted, that there's never a bad cop who tries to fix a case, there's never a DA who either fails to disclose exculpatory evidence or who might manipulate available physical evidence. And we really have to look carefully because there are significant cases of misconduct by people in the criminal justice system. And we need to safeguard the rights of those who are completely innocent. And also, I believe that there are rights that still avail to people who have been convicted even of a serious crime, and that we can't just toss out their rights on this kind of broad-based determination to protect the public at large.
And you're absolutely right, and the Constitution has a lot to say about the rights of all of us, those of us who are innocent of any crime and those who've been convicted of crimes. But you're right that a lot of people think, oh, there's no problem here because it's just a database in the hands of the police. Well, if you look at the history of police work in this country, even just over the last decade or so, you find multiple instances, documented instances, of very troubling police misconduct. Everything from over in Oakland to the Ryder scandal to the Houston Crime Lab scandal, where specifically DNA evidence was being misused. And you look at
let's not forget the Ramparts in Los Angeles, a whole crew of cops run amok, and hundreds of convictions that were overturned.
You can go on and on and on, and each one of those instances may really have ruined somebody's life. We're talking about serious consequences here that could follow from the misuse of this database by an officer. And of course, when you're talking about a database that's computerized and the misuse will be going on in the crime lab, it's very difficult to detect that. Mm-hmm. It's not as if it's going on in broad daylight, and so the temptation may be even greater for officers, either with good intentions or bad intentions, to go beyond what's allowed.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about Elizabeth Haskell.
Well, Lily Haskell was arrested at a political demonstration in San Francisco, a peace rally, when we haven't seen the police report, but we assume that a police officer claimed that she was trying to free someone, another demonstrator who'd been taken into custody. She was never, ever charged with any sort of crime. The district attorney apparently looked at this and then said, no, there's nothing there. Nonetheless, she was arrested, taken from the rally down to the jail, and when she was booked, they told her she had to give a DNA sample. And her response was, "Well, can I talk to a lawyer first, or do I really have to do this?" And they said, "You have to give it right now, and if you don't, you're going to be charged with an additional misdemeanor of refusing to give a sample, and that is a misdemeanor, can be punished by up to a year in jail." And you won't get out until you show up in court.
Mm-hmm.
And so that really does demonstrate just how this is people who are arrested, maybe with a reason, maybe with absolutely no good reason, just because the police want to get you away from a rally, are being told you have to give a sample right now. No, you can't think about it. No, you can't talk to a lawyer. And so that's what happened with Ms. Haskell.
And let me just take Haskell's case here as an example, and let's talk about the residual impact of her DNA being a part of this state crime database. Because with the new police state tactics that the federal government is permitted to use, and by extension we have to expect that some local law enforcement will use as well, we have the Patriot Act national security letters, where the FBI can issue a notice, say, to Elizabeth Haskell's bank and say, we need to look at her account to see if she did something related to this case. And they can go to that bank. They can look at her records. The bank is forbidden to notify her that they opened up her files to the FBI. And if, in addition, she's on this database, then that's another element that can be seen as incriminating by this FBI agent as they operate outside the Constitution. And this has been expanded further because the last Bush Attorney General, Mukasey, just unilaterally imposed this new system of what I call no-knock warrants, where an FBI agent essentially can just assert, I've got probable cause that Elizabeth Haskell, a known anti-war activist who's in the DNA database, has done something wrong. And then they can use these Patriot Act tactics to essentially criminalize her behavior without appropriate checks and balances, without any oversight by a judge.
It's certainly a big problem with this DNA databank that it does operate with absolutely no judicial oversight And really no oversight by the prosecutor, even in cases where the prosecutor looks at the police version of the story and says, no, we're not going to prosecute that. You're still in the database, very difficult to get out, and yes, it can have lasting consequences. Certainly, you can look at the rapid growth of DNA analysis, and you look at everything, all the news reports coming out that suggest, well, we know that certain diseases like sickle cell anemia, Down syndrome, are encoded in our DNA. Scientists are claiming, correctly or not, we don't know that our DNA has markers for all sorts of other things, ranging from Alzheimer's disease, mm-hmm. the evidence is pretty strong, to claims that it marks, there's the gay gene, for example, or propensity to alcoholism or drug abuse. So it's important to remember, not only is this happening totally without any supervision and in a lab, but it's our genetic blueprint that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So the government is taking these DNA samples, they're doing a preliminary analysis to put them in the computerized database, but then keeping the samples forever, the physical samples, so that they can conduct further analysis on them later, which really not only does it make one wonder, well, what could they do using these other legal tools, but what could they use using scientific tools to try to take a look at someone's DNA for whatever reason, to mm-hmm. discredit them, to find out more about them, using technologies that, as I say, I don't believe that we are going to, certainly in my lifetime, find that these genes can be used to predict anywhere near the number of behaviors that some people are now theorizing might be possible. But just the notion that you can say, well, look, we did the analysis, and it shows that this person has a propensity to violence or something like that, mm-hmm. or criminality.
Mm-hmm.
That in itself is very chilling.
Yeah, yeah. And also, I think it's important to note that in the criminal justice system, DNA has been used repeatedly as an exculpatory tool. That Barry Scheck, who argued the DNA in the O.J. Simpson trial and then took that money and helped start the Innocence Project, they have freed, I believe, upwards of 180 prisoners across the country now, primarily using DNA to establish, nope, he didn't do it because, the physical evidence does not support it. And so we have a critical balancing act here, because I'm not the kind of person who says DNA has no role in our criminal justice system. I just want appropriate constitutional safeguards.
And DNA is an incredibly powerful tool, and it has revolutionized our criminal justice system in terms of identifying the guilty and freeing the innocent. Like any tool, it can be used for good, or it can be used for more nefarious purposes. It's important to remember that DNA analysis is not the same as DNA databanks. An exoneration usually occurs in more than half the cases of DNA exoneration. When you look at the crime scene evidence, you compare that to a sample that an innocent person has given, usually voluntarily, and it's not the same. In a sexual assault, if the crime scene evidence is not the suspect's DNA, well, that's right there an exoneration. You don't have to use the database to do that. That doesn't require that anyone's DNA be put in a database. It's a comparison of two samples. So it's important to keep in mind, yes, DNA evidence is an incredibly valuable tool. That's not what we're talking about here. Here we're talking about putting innocent people's DNA in a criminal database.
And very clearly their approval is just obviated by the ballot measure. The law basically says you don't control your DNA when you are a suspect in a felony case.
Yes. This, we're talking about Prop 69. By coincidence, right now in California, the federal government is starting to collect DNA from people arrested on federal charges, including federal misdemeanor charges. That is something that's happening, I believe, starting just today in parts of California. So, as usual, California has been a bit of a leader in this area, and the federal government, other states, are doing the same things. And it is something that we hope to, I won't say nip it in the bud because it's gone beyond that,
mm-hmm.
but really make sure that the privacy rights of Californians and all Americans who are, of course, legally innocent, be respected.
Yeah. Now, there's another interesting case here out of Sacramento, an African-American man named Reggie Ento. His story is that he was returning some stolen property to authorities, and they turned him into a suspect. Now, I have no, you know, knowledge of the particulars of this case, but in this exchange, they took his DNA, and he is now he's never been charged, so there is no basis for them to retain his DNA, and he is fighting to have his name and information removed from this database. What is that process like, Michael?
Well, we are, our suit aims to stop it under the Fourth Amendment. There is a process under California law to try to get your DNA removed from the database if, in fact, you aren't ever convicted. That process is really inadequate and incredibly cumbersome. Let me just outline what it is.
Okay.
If, like Mr. Ento, you are arrested for possession of stolen property, that can be possession of something worth $5 in California. It's still usually is charged as a misdemeanor, but is treated as a felony at arrest. Someone is arrested because he has something that was stolen. Whether or not he knows it, that's enough for the police to arrest him. The district attorney takes a look at the case and says, there's no way that this person should be prosecuted for that crime. We're not going to bring charges. Well, under the statute, that person then has to wait until it would be the person has to wait for the statute of limitations to run out. Statute of limitations is how long the authorities have to charge you with the crime after the crime's committed. For any felony in California, that's at least 3 years. For more serious felonies, it can be 6 years. It can be life. So you're arrested for a felony. The evidence is so thin that the district attorney looks at it and says, no, we're not going to charge this even. You have to wait 3 years before you can even ask to have your DNA removed from the database. At that point, you have to give 6 months of notice to the government. If they object to having your DNA removed, it looks as if the court is not allowed to require that it be removed. Even after you've gone through all of these delays, first 3 years in a lot of cases, and then 6 months, the court has the absolute discretion to say yes or to say no. And the statute specifically says you don't have a right to appeal that. You don't have a right to use any of our legal procedures to get that decision reviewed.
Mm-hmm.
So it really is, although on paper you may have a right to do that, in reality, you have to wait these long periods of time. It's a complicated process, which, to be honest, you're going to need a lawyer to go through all of that. And
yeah,
if you don't have the money to hire a lawyer, and 80% of the people charged with felonies in California don't have the money to hire a private lawyer, you're not going to be able to navigate that system. It means a lifetime of genetic surveillance simply because you were arrested on suspicion of a felony.
Well, and almost anybody can see that that's in direct conflict with the presumption of innocence. And this will have to be resolved. So our Attorney General, Jerry Brown, who serves as the lawyer to the governor, is going to defend Proposition 69. Is that correct?
His office certainly is. We haven't seen their papers yet, but I can only assume they're going to defend it and say that it doesn't violate the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we think it does. And, 40 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court looked at the notion of what can police do. They arrest somebody for a crime, can they just go into that person's body, draw a blood sample to collect evidence? And the U.S. Supreme Court said, no. If they're going to go into your body, invade your bodily integrity, just because they've arrested you, they need to show more. They either need a warrant or they need to show that it's an emergency and they couldn't just wait. The law is pretty clearly established. If you're going to invade someone's bodily integrity just because you've arrested them, you can't do that.
Yeah. Well, and then there are sneaky ways around it, because if you're a smoker, they can pick up a cigarette butt and get a saliva sample from that. If they, you know, they take you to a fast food restaurant and give you a soda, then they try to use the straw. I mean, there are different ways that they can surreptitiously capture this physical evidence, aren't there?
Sure. And those raise very different issues about what does it mean as technology allows the government to become more and more intrusive. I mean, it's those are very different issues here, though, than forcing someone to open his mouth so that you can stick this swab in and scrape the inside of his cheek for 15 seconds in order to get a very, very pure sample. Mm-hmm. There are many cases where the government can do things the right way or they can do things the wrong way. And without going into whether it's following someone around and grabbing his old coffee cup is the right way to do things, it's pretty clear that forcing him to open his mouth to consent to this sort of invasive procedure is the wrong way under our Constitution.
Michael Risher, what are the next steps here legally?
Well, we last Friday filed a request for a preliminary injunction. That's going to be heard in the first week of December, and we're asking that the court tell the state, no, this violates the Constitution, and you have to stop this program.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see what the state's response is, and we'll take it from there.
So the initial suit is at the Superior Court level?
It's in United States Federal District Court.
Oh, it's a federal action. Okay,
yes.
Good. Well, that hopefully would get to a resolution faster than having to start up through the state apparatus.
That's our hope.
Michael Risher, again, thank you for what you're doing to protect my and our Fourth Amendment rights.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
Michael Risher from the American Civil Liberties Union, Northern California. That's the soulful, bluesy harmonica work of Norton Buffalo on Bonnie Raitt's version of Del Shannon's Runaway. Norton Buffalo passed away a few days ago at the end of October, dead from lung cancer in his late 50s. And it's really sad. Norton was diagnosed really just 8 weeks ago, and I learned from a mutual friend about it. And made plans with that friend to try to visit Norton in Paradise, California, before things advanced too far. But, well, time wasn't on our side. And I want to tell you a few stories about Norton Buffalo. If you've never heard the man's name, I urge you to Google him. Go to YouTube, and one of the things you'll find is this powerful collaboration that he did with Roy Rogers. No, not the Dale Evans, you know, trigger guy that I play Happy Trails by all the time. But Roy Rogers, the blues guitarist and slide guitarist from here in California. And this is a song that they did and produced a video on back in the early 90s called Ain't No Bread in the Bread Box.
There ain't no bread in the bread box, cause we ain't got no dough. And it seems like we ain't got enough time to go fooling around no more. You've been working so hard for oh so long, what do you got to show? Open up your eyes, little darling, let's pack up the things and go. Open up your eyes, little darling, I don't wanna live here no more. Open up your eyes, little darling, we've been here for far too long. Open up your eyes, little darling, it's time to move along.
Norton Buffalo was the official harmonica player for the Steve Miller Band, starting in 1975 when Miller released Fly Like an Eagle. And he toured with Steve Miller almost every year since the mid-1980s. He also collaborated with Roy Rogers on many projects, and they toured together. And Norton Buffalo played on, I believe, hundreds of songs and albums over the years from for a wide range of artists, some that you would know and some you'd be surprised at, including Hawaiian guitarists and children's songs that he did with Bette Midler. And I want to tell you a couple of stories about Norton, because he was somebody who touched me and touched my friend Dennis Jones. Dennis started the Freedom Foundation at San Quentin Prison in the 1970s. This was before Barry Scheck and the DNA-based Innocence Project. And Dennis had been sentenced to 7 to life for a murder, even though it was never alleged in any way that he killed somebody. He was part of a group that went to try to straighten out a bad drug deal. Guns were produced by other people. Shots were fired. Somebody died. But Dennis was a proud man who decided, rather than just rot away in jail, to start an organization to help those who are completely innocent of crimes that sent them to prison. And on many occasions, Norton accepted invitations from Dennis to play concerts for the prisoners at San Quentin, out there in the yard in the summertime. And Norton enjoyed doing that. He reveled in it. And then it took us a long time. Many people helped in the effort. But in 1999, Dennis Jones was released from San Quentin prison after 23 years in the state system. Yes, 23 years on a 7-to-life sentence. And by the way, one of the guys who pulled the trigger that day in 1975, he only served 11 years. And Norton Buffalo got to know Dennis Jones quite well. And I know he respected him and loved him in a certain way. And so on that January day, it was actually in early 2000, well, no, it was in 1999, because Gray Davis was just leaving office as the governor of California. Pete Wilson was leaving, Gray Davis was coming in. And so it was right at that transition when Dennis Jones was released. And I remember vividly that we had a little celebration at a restaurant near the San Quentin prison, and Norton Buffalo made a very serious effort to join us that day, canceling a gig that night so that he could be with us. Fast forward 10 years to January of 2009, Dennis Jones had a little party not too far from San Quentin to celebrate 10 years of freedom. One of the important people who was there was Norton Buffalo. And he came with his wife, Lisa Flores. And, of course, he brought some harps. And there were about 30 of us there, and he and Lisa performed for about half an hour and really warmed up a cold winter night. I'm really going to miss Norton, because every time I saw him, he was very positive, very optimistic, upbeat guy. He loved what he did. He loved to get in a car, drive across the country, and play gigs for 25, 30 people a night. More if he could, but he was always satisfied with a receptive audience. Didn't need a stadium full of people. So it's sad that Norton has passed away. There's going to be a memorial service for him in the form of a concert in January. And I'm looking forward to being there to celebrate the life and the music of Norton Buffalo. And here's another duet with Roy Rogers. This is a classic Elmore James tune. It's called Shake Your Money Maker. We're going to let the whole song play out. To conclude this episode of the Peter B. Collins Show, in memory of Norton Buffalo.
Shake your money maker, shake your money maker, baby, shake your money maker. Little girl, one more time for me, there was that girl.
Shake your Moneymaker. Shake your Moneymaker. Shake your Moneymaker, baby. Shake your Moneymaker. Little girl.